first interview with Mrs. Dorothy Butler of Mason County, Kentucky, on August the 2nd, 1988. The interviewer is Lynn David. All right, there we are. Now, we talked once before about your family, but you've lived in the Maeslick area for a lot of years, haven't you?
77
years.
Well, actually, 75. I was out of the Maeslick area 2 years, down in the western part of the county when we first married. But otherwise, I've been in Maeslick all my life.
Born here and raised?
Well, I was born in the county, born east, that place called Mill Creek, a very little village. It really isn't a village now. It was at that time, but Mill Creek, Kentucky is where I was born. But we have always had a link at Maeslick because we went to church. I always went to St. Rosa Lima Church. I was out of the St. Rosa Lima Church 1 year, the year we married. I've always regretted that, but we were in Maysville Parish when we married, and then that was in 1932. Then 1934, we came back to Maeslick, and we've been here ever since.
So over the past 75 years, you've seen a lot of changes.
Oh, mercy. Mercy, yes. I didn't realize how really extremely changed it was until last night, just before I went to bed. I got to jotting down a few notes, you know, particular about tobacco. Because, of course, it's a known fact that tobacco, corn, and hay are the main crops around this area. And then as a supplement, it's always been dairy and beef and sheep and hogs. And we have had all of them. But our main was tobacco and dairy. And in fact, tobacco it was always known to be the biggest money crop. And this whole area always has, and right today, depends really on the tobacco crop, you know. If the tobacco crop is good, everybody has broad smiles. If the tobacco is not, everybody has they're down, because just the whole economy of this area depends on tobacco. And although I've never smoked, my family all have and do. Some of them, you know, quit with the health things now. They hear so much about it, and I wish they all would. But I guess that seems kind of funny to hear, because if they isn't smoked, it
won't sell.
And they won't sell. But still, I try to be reasonable about it. Now, a lot of tobacco people, they're just awful against the senators that is fighting it, you know. Well, I can see that to those in those people's thinking, it don't make sense to get so much money and put out so much money for health, for research and health, and find out that it definitely is injurious to the health, and then turn right around and get another big bunch of money to subsidize the farmer to grow it. That really doesn't make sense. But then on the other hand, I know it's like everything, there's two sides to every coin, and it certainly is in the tobacco business, because I'll take my father, for instance. He did chew tobacco, and all my uncles and my two older brothers, they didn't smoke, but they chewed tobacco. And they lived to be 79, 80, and even my bachelor uncle lived to be 90 years old. And then just recently we've experienced in our family, my daughter-in-law, Velma and Jerry, her mother had never had a cigarette in her mouth to anyone's knowledge, and she died last January with lung cancer. And was never around smoking. Her husband didn't smoke, and then the second husband, he chewed, he didn't smoke, and she was really never around smoking. and never worked around it or anything, and yet she had lung cancer, and that's repeated over and over again, you know. So, as I say, there is two sides to the coin, and maybe the smoking is maybe not as injurious. Truthfully, I kind of got a feeling that it's maybe more injurious in the line of respiratory and heart than it is really cancer, because too many people get cancer that never smoked, and so I don't like to blame it all on tobacco.
You've seen a lot of changes in the way tobacco has been farmed, haven't you?
Oh, mercy, I should say. I was just thinking, it used to be when we first married, and for many years till really after around World War II. Now, I have a vivid recollection, really, of World War I and when it was over. I don't have too much recollection of during the time of it, but I certainly do remember the armistice day.
Do you? What was it like?
Well, it just looked like it was going to go on and on and on. And we didn't have a telephone, I remember. And a neighbor, Mr. Mike Walton, had a telephone, and that is his grandson, Mike Walton, that lives down in Hillcrest. That's his grandson. And so the communication was very poor, of course, and I was just seven, but I'm sure, now thinking back, that it came in by the way of a telegram. And then there was operator system, and that was all people that done, you know. And they knew everybody's, if there was a fire or anybody died, those operators in that hookup. So they were told to call as many people, at least some people in every community, and tell them that the armistice had been signed. And then that person was, each one of them that was called, they was told, spread the news. And I actually, because the armistice was signed at 11 in the morning on November the 11th, and I'm really not sure whether the news got here on the 11th, and it might possibly have been the 12th when we heard it. I'm really not sure of that. And of course, Dad and all them was long gone. But I can remember Dad was shucking corn, and that was hand shuck, you know, get the ear off and pull it out and then throw it and let it dry and then haul it in. And Mr. Mike Walton had a telephone, and he was one of the ones that was called. And he came over to where Dad was shucking corn, he and Uncle Bill that farmed with Dad, and he told him, well, the armistice has been signed. So Dad came in early. We ordinarily had dinner at 12 or 10 after, but he came in a little bit early, and we were out playing, and we seen right away that they were walking faster. So Anna Lee, my older sister, and I took off to go and meet them, and Dad said, well, run tell your mother the war is over, the armistice has been signed. So we took out a running, and we came. And when we got in the yard, I can remember that we both hollered, we won't have to eat any more cornbread. To us, that was the big thing, because the flour was so hard to get. You just couldn't get enough, really, to supply a family. And I don't think they had what they would call rationing at that time. In fact, I'm sure they didn't. But in order to get, say, like a 24-pound sack of flour, you would also have to buy a 10 or a 12-pound bag of cornmeal. So you have, because they knew that flour wouldn't last you, so then you'd have to eat cornbread. So we would have to eat cornbread one meal a day. And so that was a big thing in our life. And then our mother was always considered to be and was an excellent cook, and she always, by having a large family, she made a lot of pies and cakes and candy, but you didn't get the sugar, so we were deprived of that. So then we said, oh, Mom, you can make candy tonight. So that's about the time of my earliest recollection. But then back to the tobacco business, it was about World War II, after World War II, when it really took a drastic change. Because when we first married, you just didn't have to have any machinery hardly at all to raise a crop of tobacco. You had to have a good team of horses, two work horses, and a land plow, they called it, and some called it a breakup plow, and then a cutting hare. Well, a drag would come first, and that was just big boards with weights on it, and the man usually made that himself. And then a cut-up hare when the time come to cut the ground. And then they had to go back over it again with a double-A hare that had teeth that would drag any of the big old rough clods out of it, you know. And then the ground was ready. Well, now, and then, of course, you had to have a tobacco setter. At least in my recollection, they had a horse tobacco setter. And
how'd that work?
They'd be two horses, and then a big barrel of water, and then a seat, these iron seats, was up on that. And then right down here behind, there was two men. And of course, at that time, it was just unheard of for men to of women to work in tobacco. In fact, all of our family, and Nathan really died, and my brothers did too, almost think it was disgrace for a woman to work in tobacco. That was a woman's place, just wasn't in the field. And I'm not sure but what they... You know, we're kind of right, because I really don't believe a woman's body is made to lift that heavy tobacco like they do now. And then there's a click, and that out of that barrel comes water. And you, each person, if it's a right hand and a left hand person, now that works grand, because then they have, and each one, and every time that click comes, they put the space, and when the water comes, the plant is spaced, and out the row and back, and of course that is still today, except it's tractor pull today, and it's much bigger, and a lot of the big farmers have four people setting it instead of the two, and that in that sense that hasn't changed very much, and each one of those plants has to be handled by the hand, and same way pulling them out of the bed, they have to be hand handled. So it does, it still does take a lot of work, but nothing compared to how it was after World War II, and well, really up until the last 25 years. And it really isn't, I don't think, for the best, because there probably is a good many young men would like to be farmers, but it's just so expensive they just couldn't go in. Now, probably, possibly we had, Nathan's father gave him the first team, and other than that, we might have had $100 invested when we started raising tobacco. And now it's 25 and 30,000 that they have to start raising tobacco.
Could they go back to raising it by hand like that with the horses, or would it just not be competitive on today's market?
It wouldn't be competitive, and then I don't think anybody would, when I think of how they used to, I don't think anybody would, all desire to farm would go with the, they just would not, because they used to say, and certainly was the truth, it was a year-round work, and they were busy just about all the time. The farmer, there wouldn't be hardly a day that he wasn't in that crop of tobacco doing something all during the growing season. Well, now they start out. Of course, they have to, back in those days, It was usually about late January. The market lasted a lot longer. The market went on until March. Well, as far as our speaking, it was usually about late January when we would finish selling the tobacco. Nathan would always try to sell half before Christmas and then half on the season after Christmas. And Dad and Uncle Bill and them did pretty much that same way. And the first few days of February, anytime you'd get a sunny day, it might be cold, but they would go out and take those horses, and they had a sled, and they'd start going around and trimming dead limbs off, getting the wood to burn the tobacco bed. And they'd bring that up, and then they'd like to get their plot that they were going to have their tobacco bed plowed up early. And then they had to burn the tobacco bed, and that was a gruesome thing. It'd be cold wind blowing, yet that hot fire, and almost every man would always get sick afterward because the change of body temperature, you know. And then they have to take a pitchfork, that's a long handle thing, longer than a hoe, with prongs on it, and move that hot burning big logs a little to heat that ground that the weeds wouldn't come, you know, in it. That's what that was the purpose of burning the bed.
Oh, it was to keep weeds from coming up.
Keep weeds from coming up, uh-huh. It would heat that, and you had to have a pretty good judgment as to how long. I think maybe each big bunch would, I think maybe about 15 minutes, and then the farmer would have to take that pitchfork and move that, and then throw more on so it'd get a good hot fire, and that would kill the weed seeds in that, because they didn't use the same plot like they do now. They picked and they was very particular in picking where it would sort of have a eastern exposure so they could get some sun, you know, and where it was real fertile and where it would drain good. And then by the time they got their beds, then they was working the ground, getting it ready. And we did have better seasons then than we do now. They was more normal than they are now. You could count on about every week you'd get a seasonable rain. And, we did have some droughts, such as in the 30, but that just stands out big. I mean, well, 36 then, it was a very smart of a drought. But even earlier than that, and I'm sure down through the ages, we've always had droughts, but we never did. This is really the first of my recollection. We had three consecutive dry years. If you had a drought this year, then next year you'd have a seasonable year. And then they would start preparing the soil, because the plants was up then and growing. And usually around the last few days of May, the plants would be ready to be put in the ground. And almost simultaneously, they would try to have their corn already in the ground before the tobacco. And then it would start to plow. And you would plow and plow. Well, now they hardly ever, they don't even... they just don't think it's necessary, and maybe it isn't, because they start out, instead of working the ground, they start out doctoring the ground. 2 weeks before, they have a chemical for to keep the weeds from growing, a chemical to keep the from having black root, black shank, and their root rot and all those different things. And then they have another chemical that kills the insects in the ground, and one for blue mold and all those things. And that all goes in the ground before the tobacco goes in. And now this year, ours never had a plow in it. And Dickie last week didn't have any weeds in it. It really didn't need, because the ground was dry. And he knew if he plowed it, that would stir up the soil and let some moisture out, which wouldn't be good for it. And just last week, after we got that first rain, I think he and another teacher friend of his I think they might have put in an afternoon, a whole afternoon, and walking through with their hoe and chopping the weeds out of it. And that was just typical. It just, they set it out, and in many cases, they where they have crops settled, separated, different, because so many people lease land, and they'll have 5 or 6 miles or 8 or 10 miles apart, you know. And the whole picture is just changed drastically. And then after the tobacco would get in years gone by, then the worms, because we've always had pests and insects, you know, then the worms. Well, our grandchildren, I think they think I'm imagining that, the man had to go through and pull each one of those worms off by his hand, put it on the ground, and smash it, step on it, so it wouldn't lay its eggs, and then another crop. Plant by plant and leaf by leaf on the tobacco, and it would be up usually between knee-high and waist-high for him that time, but it would be impossible to get every one of them. So he, they would be a second crop, so that would be twice at least he would have to go through.
That'd be back-breaking, wouldn't it?
Yes. But the real backbreaker will be yet to come, because they'd have to reach down and turn this leaf, because worms, like anything they that's doing damage, they like to hide, and they are not going to stay up where you get to see them. They're under the leaf, you know. So that means bend over, turn the leaf, get the worm, put it on the ground, and step on it. And some would, in later years, would hire boys and then pay them so much to get a half a gallon bucket. If they get a half a gallon bucket full of worms, they pay them so much. Then I think they would pour coal oil on them. But the farmer, if he farmed alone, he just did it the other way. And now they go through with their sprayer and just spray that. And I sometimes wonder if maybe the treatment that they do to both the soil and the tobacco, if that isn't more damaging than the tobacco itself. Now, I just sometimes wonder if it isn't. And then after they got through with the worming, pretty soon the bloom would start coming. And they had, there again, they had to go through twice. And because they didn't let it bloom out where they'd have this great big bloom up high, because at that time they thought, and I noticed this year, they're kind of coming back to it. They think that takes the strength or the substance out of the tobacco. Too much of that goes to produce that big bloom. So they would get it when it was just starting to bloom, or as the older farmers called it, when it's in the bud. That bud was, it'd be about like that coming. They reach down and break that out. Well, some of them wouldn't be. So then the next week, when they got through with the 5 acres, they had to start right over, because those that wasn't, then that was ready. And then in about another 2 weeks, then they had to hope and pray they'd get a good rain on it, you know. And usually that that took care. They didn't have a lot of the insects that we have now, I'm sure, but they did have pear screen. And if there was any other insects, there's a lot of insects that wasn't here, I'm sure.
What's pear screen?
It's a powder, and it is green, Paris green. That just happened to be the name, like 7 is now. But it's been outlawed or outdated long ago. Paris green, P-A-R-I-S-G-R-E-E-N, Paris green. And that would kill, really kill all, but it was very poisonous. And but now Strange, Dad, and all the farmers that were tobacco chewers, they'd go through and put that on. And of course it's true that they did get maybe 2 or 3 rains. But if anybody ever got sick or anybody was ever killed, it was never known from chewing the tobacco that had that Paris green on it. And other than that, there wasn't any any insects to bother the tobacco in those days. And
why do you think we have different ones today?
Oh, I don't know, but there definitely is. There's new ones just all the time. And new chemicals that I don't think the chemistry department at the University of Kentucky, really, they're just experimenting all the time. Of course, that's why we have an experiment station, and they're just experimenting to see which works the best and with the least damage to the environmental. And of course, the environmental agency has come in, and that has stopped so many. And I don't find any fault with that either, because...
Was your father worried about the environment?
No. They never... Of course, there wasn't all the pollution and all the thing. No, and we never thought about worrying about an environment. We just thought the air was clean and pure. And, of course, it really was in that time, because there wasn't many cars on the road. And... Because there wasn't too many cars in Mason County till after World War One, and then they were. Because my mother died in 1923, and going to her funeral was the first time I'd ever ridden in a car. It had always been horse and buggy up until that time, because we didn't have roads that very many cars could go on. You know.
What were the roads like here? Were they dirt or clay?
They were rock. I can remember when we went, that was in the early 20s, over on number 11, that's where we went to school. Of course, at that time, they called it the Fleming Road. And I can remember several places around Mill Creek that going in a buggy wheel, you know how big a buggy wheel, and there was holes that the buggy would drop down to halfway the hubcap.
That's a deep hole.
That's a deep hole, and any amount of them. And then when it would rain, those holes would fill up, you know. And of course, at that time, we had to walk to school. And I never did, but the boys, that would be a great thing to try to push somebody else in that puddle, you know, where the water would gather in. And 68, now it was maintained better because, well, I don't know that they put any more work or any more money or any more time, but it was a better road. It was what they call macadamized. It was the first macadamized road in this area, so it consequently held up the hard top better. But then a road like this, actually, when we moved out here, there was great big roads. That was in 1934 that we moved here. And it was real narrow. You had to, of course, it's not all that wide now, but it's been widened. And it was up a hill. Now, like this bank out here that you see at our place, the road was right up even with that bank. And down at Thompson's, where you see their bank, the road goes, and their house is down. The road was right down even with their house. Uh-huh. They took it off of our hill and filled in that hill down there. And so, it just wasn't time for automobiles back in the late teens and early 20s, you know.
In the teens and 20s, who maintained those roads?
They had road crews. They had both state and county, and it wasn't uncommon at all to, I think they would probably get them, but you'd go along and they'd be a great big, they first put the rocks on the road, on the side, and then I guess it was way up in the 20s when they'd have a rock crusher. But men with nap hammers went along, sitting on that pile of rock, two or three, and they would break those and fill in the bad places in the late teens and the early 20s. That is how they maintained their babies. So then back to the tobacco, as I say, changes has been, I believe, more in the raisin tobacco than anything else that I know of. Corn hasn't changed that much, and hay hasn't changed. They used to haul it in shocks and then put it in big stacks, and then later on some bales came, but it hasn't drastically changed like tobacco. Then we stopped on the worming and then the topping. And then it'd be about a week or about 2 weeks when the suckers, and that's a new thing that grows out from each, and that's a terrible nuisance to the tobacco, but that's just the way it was. For each leaf, there would be a new shoot would come out there, and you have to go through, and every one of those leaves, I forget just how many leaves, I think like in the early 20s, and they have to be careful not to bruise that leaf and not to break it, and yet get in there and pull that sucker out of there. But the nature of tobacco, if they took the top two suckers off, then they would only, that would encourage them to come right back. But if they left the two top ones, the strength of the tobacco went ahead and grew to them, and they'd go on and be like just a second crop of tobacco. They'd grow up and bloom, but there wouldn't any more come in down on the other leaves. So they'd have to walk through and take a hand, and there again, handle each leaf of that tobacco and pull that sucker out. And then when they got through that first time, and then they would wait, and they always trusted that they'd get a good rain then, and then it would begin to ripen, both age and then the removal of the sucker growth, and it would begin to ripen, begin to turn. And after it, and at that time, there was a great stress put on having ripe tobacco, and because, of course, there wasn't a great foreign market back in the 30s like there is now. There was some, but it wasn't great like it is. And, so many of those countries weren't even, there wasn't as many of them, and they wasn't as civilized. And they might have been more civilized if they didn't smoke tobacco, but it was mostly kind of the consumption supplied the United States. And, of course, the farm, we did have to have a lot of farm tobacco. But it wasn't in the quality is not stressed on tobacco now, both in the quality of the plant itself and the way it's handled is not stressed like it was then. Every man just... his tobacco crop was his pride and joy. He really enjoyed it, and on a Sunday it would be a lot of, even the horse and buggy day, a lot of men's way of entertainment was get his horse and buggy and drive 8 or 10 miles one way or the other and see the other man's crop that would compare his, you know. And many a time we've taken Sunday afternoon drives, get the kids all in the car and drive up 68. And of course we was always going to Maysville down and across over to the Fleming Road, or maybe go to Flemingsburg and go out this road and come around the other way to get an idea. And if any man ever stopped to visit, the first place he took him, now they take them to the television and the VCR, but they went right straight to the tobacco patch. And it was a man's pride and joy if he had a good crop, and he worked to the extent to get it, to have it a pride and a show crop. And then when the tobacco began to get yellow, then again he'd have to go through that, and with the... they take two rows and break one of the out of the row, this row, with his right hand, one out with his left hand, and that way each trip he made he got two rows, taking those last two suckers out of the top. And I
is that,
think
is that called ripening then, when it starts to turn yellow?
That's ripening. And then I think probably after he broke those last two, usually in about 2 or 3 days, and maybe even the next day, they could go right on and cut. And at that time, a 5 acre, usually they thought a one man farm was about like ours. Ours is 113 acres, and any place 100 to 110 or 20 or 30 acre, that was considered a one man's operation. He could handle that. Of course, he'd have to get some help in, but most of the work he would do it himself. It was usually just the cutting and housing that he had to.
Where'd he get the help?
Well, most neighbors. One person would be a little bit ahead of the other, and you would exchange work. Usually about 2 or 3 families would kind of join together, and maybe the men would work in one crop 2 or 3 days or maybe 4 days, because the habit at that time was to cut tobacco in the afternoon. They like to cut it in the afternoon after it thoroughly dried off, and turn it the tails away from the sun so it wouldn't sunburn. And then,
now explain that to me.
Well, the tails is the top of the tobacco, and if you put that facing the west, then all of the top leaves is down, and that's where the sun. So if you turn it back the other way, the tails turn the other way away from the sun, then the sun does not sunburn it. And they would leave it out then in the that night to let it wilt real good, and it would be just as flimsy as it could be, and that water would sort of drip out of it. Then the next morning, well, then they, before they go to bed, then they would quit and they'd do their milking and feeding hogs or their beef cattle, whatever they had. And then before they'd go to bed, they would go and pile all that tobacco, put it in piles, so in just in case it rained, they would just be the top two that would get wet. They wouldn't dare want their tobacco to get wet, and because then there's mud, and then they get mud on it, and so they put it in piles. Plus, it loads easy. The next morning, you go, instead of just having to take every stick out of the ground, you go to these, I don't really remember how many sticks usually they put in a pile. A few still does that. Now, Dickie does it if it looks like it's going to rain. But the majority of them don't, because so many of them have, it isn't uncommon at all to see 20 or 30 men in a tobacco field cutting tobacco, you know, now the big tobacco growers. And then they, next morning, they would haul that tobacco into the tobacco barn, and they'd usually have to have 4 or 5 to put it in the top because they had to fill. But then after they'd get it, 2 or 3 could handle it real good and finish it up. And a lot of times the men did that way. They would start, get each one of them, and it was a habit that down this particular area, all along in July, why somebody or some 2 or 3 men, would 4 maybe, would get in the car and they'd go down in the mountain area. And then they would engage some mountain men to come and house.
The mountain people didn't try to grow any themselves?
No, they didn't. The land wasn't suitable. It was,
Did they go back to certain families every year?
Yes, to a degree, if you got good hands. And then they got to coming, and so many times, even in that time, and still today, the mountain people, as soon as the boy got big enough to work, why, there wasn't much need in him going to school, you know. Now, that never was in this area, in my recollection. All my brothers went on and went to school. And of course, there is some of that same element that when they're sick, of course, then the law got that they 16, they have to, and I wish they would get it to 18, that they have to go to school.
Now, did your brothers get out of school during tobacco harvesting time, though?
Yes, they'd have to, and Nathan did too, and the teachers and the system was real leany. Of course, we didn't start as early. We didn't start until the day after Labor Day. All schools started the day after Labor Day then. So usually the any place around the 25th to the 28th of August, you would begin. So a lot of people would be kind of well along. But even at that, if there was too much of a big, pretty good sized crop, and especially if a boy was a junior or senior, he could almost have to miss the first month of school. Of course, September is a short month. And then, as I say, the teachers understood that. They were lenient, and we didn't have the system that if you miss so many days in a semester, you automatically fail. They didn't have this, what they call the minimum foundation, that if you're not in school, they pay the system by head count. And it was hot in the schools. There was no such things as air condition. And usually the first week, really, the teacher was getting acquainted with the children, and you really didn't have much assignments at all. They would just kind of, in fact, most of them reviewed the that was a teacher's hobby at that time, to kind of review. And if you were in the sixth grade, she wants to know how well you learned the fifth grade. So they really didn't lose that much. And but as they got along, junior and senior, the maths and the science, and someone would have notes for them, and they it worked very well. So, because most the big boys were out of school the first through September. If they was ready to start school in October, why they were ready for it. But after they'd gone through tobacco, they was glad. that was a kind of a vacation.
Folks went to the mountains to get these men to help them. Mm-hmm. Did they provide housing for them down here?
Well,
or what?
A few people would have a little tenant house in later years. But no, you took them in your home, and now you couldn't dare do that now. They would come. Usually you would go after them, and then, as I say, later years, after World War II, maybe one would get an old car, and he'd bring about eight with him, and he'd drop two or three off here. We usually just would have two. But, and one time, I think a time that will stand out with me as much as anything, my brothers were farming down on the James Piles and the Davy Longnecker, and they really had a big crop. And they had the time set for these, but their crop wasn't quite ready, and Nathan's was ready. So they said, well, you go ahead and take them, because they caught a ride down, said, you go ahead and take them and, this week, and then you will get a pretty good start on yours, and then they will, we'll be ready for them next week. So Nathan was gracious to have them, you know, and I think he had one engaged for himself, so we had three that time. And they came here on Sunday afternoon, and that Sunday night, it never rained like it rained that time. It rained, and it rained, and it rained like it had never rained before. All day Monday, this was a screen porch at that time, and they weren't a bit neat. They would go out, and they all had a French harp. Once in a while, you'd have one have an old guitar, and but they all had a French harp. And they would play that French harp. And they stayed here one solid week, three big meals a day that I had to fix for them. Never got 1 hour of work out of it. It rained the whole time. Through Friday, then Saturday it commenced to drying up, and then Sunday. Well, the boys are my brothers had them, so they had to go down to them. So they had 1 week. Of course, it wasn't their fault.
No,
but it sure stands out to me. And we had they slept upstairs in the room over the kitchen, and I would go upstairs, and finally I was just heart sick that I didn't even go upstairs the last 2 or 3 days. And when they left on Sunday, I took Monday, and I swept up 2 3-gallon buckets of mud. It was done dry, just great big cloth. Now, I would keep the steps. We didn't have carpet on it then. It was just hardwood steps. And every day, I would clean that. But Uncle Denny was living with us at that time, and he was up in the front. He was upstairs and in the front part, so he didn't have to go through it. Dirtiest beds and the dirtiest house that ever I've seen. Nathan would tell him, and Nathan always took off his shoes, and Uncle Danny did too. Tom did too. They would throw their shoes out of the field in the house. But you could not get them to take it off. I've known them to take them off outside and come in here. And then after I'd go to bed, they'd go back out and put them on and go up the steps. And now that time, as far as mountain hands, will always, as long as I have any mental facilities. And they weren't hard to cook for. There's a lot of things they didn't like. But in the second day, you found if you cook brown beans today and navy beans tomorrow and great northern beans the next day and had boiled potatoes today and fried potatoes tomorrow, and they weren't real great. Now, they didn't care for chicken. They didn't care for beef. They liked bacon and eggs. They'd eat like 4 eggs of a morning, but we had eggs, so, you know, that wasn't too much. But I look back now and think, because light bread, as we know it today, was almost unheard of thing. It was all biscuits, you know. 3 times a day, you'd make biscuits because no refrigeration.
They tell you many stories about their lives in the mountains?
No, they would to the men outside. They would to Nathan and my brothers and them. But they wouldn't hardly talk around a woman. They'd just sit there and eat. And just the only noise you'd hear was their fork or their knife hitting their plate. No, they wouldn't. But they'd tell Nathan out in the field, and my brothers, they tell them, you know, tales.
What did Nathan or them tell you any of the stories that they told them?
Yes, uh-huh.
Remember any of them?
Oh, yes, they would. They were great on fighting. They'd tell the big fighting, and that is still, in to a great degree, they tell me, in Mountain Blood today. They're proud of all the people that they could whip, and hunting tales they tell about. And see, that's sort of how they lived an awful lot of them, because there wasn't Social Security, there wasn't SSI, there wasn't welfare. Now, the women, and that was mountain custom, and I think it still is today, the women raised a big garden, and they would can and pickle food. But the men would fish and hunt. And the women would make quilts and all sort of crafts, and they still do today, because if you go down, we went down this fall to Middlesboro, and anytime you get off of the interstate, kind of in the where the real mountain people live, and they say every Sunday, I'd love to go down there and just have a lot of time and stop and see their beautiful crafts and quilts. They have their line, have big long, just like clotheslines, and have them out on display out there, you know. And that gets in a little money for them to have sugar, and then they maybe one will work someplace, and they will work a while in the coal mines. But of course, that's sort of a dead issue in the mountains now. But they go out and get game, they fish, and then they come in and dress that, and they would salt that down, and I think some of the game would keep in salt and barrels of salt. But I sometimes wonder how they really did exist. I'm sure many times, and I'm sure even still today, there's a lot of them are hungry sometimes, and I'm sure a lot of them are cold. Of course, there is a lot of wood, and they usually They usually burn wood, but it's a poor existence in the real Appalachian part. You go down through there, traveling, you think we're the deprived people because they have the good roads, you know, and all these beautiful brick homes. And but if you get away from that, everybody tells me that it's real stale poverty. And some of these welfare and the Appalachian people that's helping them, they go through, and I've seen a lot of the tapes, the VCRs on them, and they need educating as well as helping, because and we've had a few of them come down here and throw their ashes, just walk to the front porch and throw their ashes. Same thing with tin cans. Since they've been getting commodities and things, I've seen the pictures of them where they just walk to the back door and cans just piled up. The girl that helps me in the yard down at her place, she's got a junk pile right at the side of the house as big as this whole room. They just throw all their tin cans out, and they have been handed out so much to that they really think that is somebody's job to come there. And of course they don't have any trucks, and they don't have any tractor or anything to haul that kind of stuff away. And eventually someone is going to have to come in there and haul that away, because I know her pile, and she hasn't been down there but a year, and it's as big as it would just about fit in this room, of tin cans and old broken chairs and old clothes and all such as that. They just they're just a complete different culture than we are. It's I tell her every time I take her home, I said, Bessie, that's going to be a real rat harbor. Rats is going to get in there. They'll be getting in bed with you. And they will. They really will.
You're talking about Bessie Colmeyer?
Uh-huh. She helps me. Of course, she's helping Buddy Cropper in the tobacco now. But she helps me rake leaves. And
she's a hard worker.
Yes. But, you know, no management, whatever. But they can... and they make good money. They make big money now helping. They didn't when they were out here, but they do. Buddy Cropper's got all he, I think he has about, I believe it's 65 or 70 or 75,000 pounds of tobacco. And so they're just working at it all the time. And he pays them well, but they just have no management of them. Plus they get welfare, and they get food stamps, and they, they don't get food stamps, they get commodities. Mm-hmm. And they just think that, they don't think a thing. If one of them get mad, or one of them gets drunk and kick the screen out of the door, then write to Miss Kehoe, and she's supposed to bring them out a new screen door, and tear up a VCR, and then, of course, I don't think she ever has brought them, but radios, oh my goodness, how the radios they've had, and televisions, and then they just know that it will be replaced, where you and I know when we get it, we better take care of it, because, you know, who's going, number one, is going to have to replace it. Uh-huh, it's...
When you were growing up, who were your neighbors around here that time?
The Everett place on this road has changed mostly twice. Now, the farm back here, it was Sapp's. Mrs. Sapp still lives in Mays Lick. She's 85 years old, and her husband died in 72. Well, he got...
that was farm right directly behind this?
Right behind us, uh-huh. And they were there... and then the farm on back was Huber's. Now, they are still there. The Huber's are still there. I think they bought that farm and came up there in 1914. But, of course, the older man we call Pop, he's gone. And then Charles took over, and he's gone. And now Glenn is on back.
Were there any characters in your neighborhood out here?
No.
Any people you really stood out?
Well, we had all three nice neighbors all the time. Just, you'll have to talk about it.
Wait a minute. Let's turn this on. We had, when you started coughing, and we turned it off for a minute, you said that there were some fires in Maze Lick, mm-hmm. and that you remembered some mm-hmm. of them.
Well, the one I think I remember, we were going to Lewisburg School, so it was had to be, and I guess someone has a record, but we came to Maze Lick in 1926, so it was before that. And Lewisburg did not have a gym, and Maze Lick did not have a gym. I believe it must have been probably 24, 25, because Nathan was going to Maze Lick, and he was in high school. And they played basketball out on the outside court, and we could see the flames and the terrible smoke from Maze Lick, from Lewisburg over to Maze Lick. And Nathan said that he could remember that they rang, it was time for agriculture. I guess he was either a freshman or a sophomore, probably a freshman. And that they rang the bell, the fire bell, and all of the children got out. And then they told, because of course it was long ways away, there was no danger, but they, I don't really know why they rang the fire bell. And then the principal called all the high school boys back in, and he told them there was this big fire up to Maze Lick. And so they got them in a bus, because nobody drove a car to school back in those days. And the bus loaded them up and took them, and the public well, and then down the old spring house is where, and there was another, two or three other cisterns. And they took buckets, and you get a bucket and hand it to me, and that on and on. And that's how they fought that fire. Of course, it was virtually impossibility to...
When did it burn down?
All this area that's parallel with the pool room, where that building is, that's Charlie Woods, uh-huh. you know. Well, now there was... there was at least two buildings in there. I guess maybe, although I'm not sure. I think it was just where the road or the alley or whatever they call it goes down. I think that was just a path that went extended farther. It burned all of that, and it burned for days because there was no. Community firefighters, nobody had water to put it out, and I think there was one of them, one of the buildings had a lot of coal in there.
So the coal all burned.
The coal had just had to burn.
Was anybody hurt?
No, I don't believe there's anybody mm-hmm. ever been hurt in anyone. And then when we came on Sunday to church, then of course everybody, as soon as church was out, everybody went down to mm-hmm. see the fire, but it, and you could smell it all the way to Lewisburg. Now, that is really all I remember
yeah.
of that one. But
well, I really appreciate you visiting with me this morning.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just really glad.
Oh,
really
it's been
glad.
Enjoyable.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.